Hi, you're listening to Great Thinking, Ideas and Conversations from Greenbelt. We're Greenbelt. We're somewhere to believe in.
Yes, hello. I'll be given a signal to start at some point. Thank you very much for coming along at the end of a hot day when I'd do like a show of hands who'd rather be in the Jesus arms already, but then I probably would just go with you and it would be awkward. Okay. Okay. I'm going to be reading a little bit because I'm not as cool and spontaneous as some of the other people who've been here. And I've also got a presentation as well. So I look a bit, just to age myself, a bit Jean-Michel Jarre with the kind of thing, but no light effects, sadly. So thank you for coming. I'm going to start with a bit of history. Does anyone recognise the place in this picture? So a few people. So if you ever visit London and you travel to the very busy, bustling area of London Bridge and then turn down a quiet street nearby, you'll come across a wild garden hidden behind high fences and walls. This is that garden. In the 1990s, the land was discovered to be the final resting place of thousands of people who'd been deemed unworthy of Christian burial in the Middle Ages. Among them were quite a number of women who had worked in local brothels. Brothels that had, and I think this is a fascinating piece of church history, been licensed by the church who also collected the profits. Oh, I know. The women, along with their illegitimate children, were hidden away from respectable society even after they died. And as far as we know, the Bishop of Winchester, who was the one who profited at the time, is no longer involved in such activities, but I will have a little anonymous tip line if anyone wants to let me know afterwards. But now, after hundreds of years, the church is trying to make amends for who it judged worthy or not, or at least some parts of the church are. And now, and this is something that people can go along to, once a month a procession makes its way from Southwark Cathedral nearby to the garden, which is now called Crossbones, in an act of remembrance. And the reason this is a little bit relevant to what I'm talking about today is for a long time the place was known as the Single Woman's Churchyard. Can you guess why? Well, simply that the term single woman was interchangeable with sex worker. The centuries often haven't been kind to single people, women in particular. And outside of the framework of coupled life, where a woman was legally subsumed into a man's identity, I mean, who knew what havoc and disruption they were capable of? They actually had a word for it, coverture, an 18th century legal commentary, which will partly appear. Has it gone yellow? Okay. So an 18th century legal commentary described it as, by marriage, the husband and wife are one person in law. You can guess who wins. That is, the very being or legal existence of the woman is suspended during the marriage, or at least is incorporated and consolidated into that of the husband, under whose wing, protection and cover she performs everything. She basically ceased to exist once she got married. And the married woman was known in legal terms as the femme covert, which sounds almost like a spy, but actually just means the covered woman. So that was it. She was covered by her husband. Everything she owned belonged to him. She had no rights to generate any income for herself, to sign legal contracts, buy property. Anything that made her separate to him was out. And if you wanted to be exempt from this at the time, it was simple. Just don't get married. You just need to have your family to agree to it, have other ways to support yourself, and of course, back then, most women didn't. Or, little loophole, you could be queen. Queens had more options. They could not be covered, legally speaking. And it seems like ancient history, but actually it's not. For women marrying even a few decades ago, well within many of our lifetimes, options were still very limited. Women were steered towards marriage by social expectation and by the law. I'm going to do a quick quiz. Okay, so we know that the first women got the vote about 100 years ago, 101, although it obviously wasn't granted willingly, and only some women, and only if they were over 30, and only if they met certain property requirements. But what year did it become possible for British women to open a bank account in their own name? 1975. Thank you, person who looked at my talk maybe earlier. Very good, very good. Which is also the same year that an American woman could apply for a credit card in her own name. So until then, you simply couldn't do it. Women had to wait until 1978 before they could be pregnant without being fired from their jobs. And maternity pay wasn't a legal requirement in the UK until, anyone know? 1986. So plenty of people in here will have had mothers who decided to have them without knowing whether or not they would get any support from work at all. So it was quite risky. And rape within marriage wasn't recognised until 1991. So the idea that women could be single, have choices, flourish, came with significant roadblocks. Marriage was the ideal, and anything that allowed women to choose alternatives was often prevented by law, if not by convention. And the church loved it. The church was wedded to it. That's a little marriage joke. Okay. Christian equaled respectable. But the version of marriage that became known as Christian hadn't been carried faithfully from ancient times, not at all. It is something of a hybrid, an odd combination of, I'm going to give you the little list, Old Testament patriarchy, which was men mostly in charge, but, you know, without the polygamy, pretty much. New Testament orderliness, but without the championing of singleness. It was much more one woman, one man, get on with it, very strict. Tudor times, now introducing their beloved tradition of loving and honouring and not parting until death, if we just overlook the fact that divorce was central to the creation of the Church of England. Yep. Victorian purity. You know, women had no legal rights. And even though these marriages were praised for being decades long, where else could they go? You know, they had to stay once they were married, and those who didn't fit into the mould could end up as fallen women, and often really bad things happened to them. And then there's a little bit of the 1950s too, the only time really in modern Western history where women have been happily at home, apparently happily at home, and men were the breadwinners. So that's kind of the bits that most people think Christian marriage consists of, and it's not one thing. It's certainly not this sort of biblical marriage that people have pulled wholesale from thousands of years ago into the present. And it's an institution that finds itself still in the grip of a post-sexual revolution panic, and a call for some Christians to return to the good old days, which are this hybrid of all the useful bits plucked from history rather than one thing that ever existed in its own right. For a lot of Christians, marriage equaled one woman and one man, abstinent and then wildly passionate in a lifelong faithful union. I might have expected a bit of a laugh then, because you just, you know, who knows? Of course, fertility was guaranteed, as was contentment. And you kind of think, well, doesn't that sound a bit out of date? Are marriage and the traditional family still so beloved of Christians in the present day? Well, in a moment of madness, one that ended up taking 3 years and became a book, I decided to find out. Silly me. Right. I started to research not only the history and present state of singleness, love, and relationships, hence the little history lesson that we just sat through, but also what the future could look like, especially where faith was a factor. I created a survey that nearly 1,500 people responded to, and I asked about everything. I didn't really hold back, and neither did they. I thought, oh, I'll just ask a few questions and see what happens. And I think 200 people replied in the first weekend and poured out their hearts. So this was obviously something that really mattered to people. And many people that I surveyed were taught this historical hybrid version of marriage in one form or another. Some were quite young, just out of their teens. Others were in their 50s and 60s. But they'd all had a similar kind of teaching of this odd Christian marriage that actually was made up of all these different bits. They were taught it regardless of sexual orientation or of any other preferences. Single life was rarely mentioned, much less as a positive alternative. And the patterns and shapes of life may have changed in the present, but perceptions and prejudices are, as you know, a lot harder to shift. Can anyone think of any positive words exist even now for the state of single womanhood? I've got a bit of a list. I've got spinster, which did start off as a positive because it meant an independent woman making her living through spinning. I've got old maid, I've got thornback. You have to reach a certain age, a grand old age of, I think it was of 25, and then you became a thornback. And then Christmas cake, which meant you were good if you were consumed by a certain date. None of them are nice words. Men may have had it better, being eligible bachelors and men about town, but overall, society has remained suspicious or pitying of single people. Just after the First World War, there was a generation of women who'd been brought up to be good wives, so they couldn't go to university, they couldn't earn their own livings. Their aim, their purpose in life, they were brought up just to get married, and they found themselves forced into singleness when the First World War took the men that they would have married and also the Spanish flu epidemic. And there were estimated to be 2 million women in the UK at this time. And they got the label surplus women, which is quite grim. But apparently Agatha Christie's Miss Marple was one of these surplus women. They were women that were sort of forced into independence and single life simply because there were just no options. And actually, there are some women who replied to me who said, well, church life is quite similar to that. You know, you're told that you'll grow up to get married. And actually, when you don't, you have to figure it out differently. And these women had no choice but to make lives outside of social expectations. But they were pitied for it. They weren't respected. And no matter how much social upheaval occurred, even another world war, Christianity still championed traditional marriage. So after World War II, where there'd been a 70% rise in sexually transmitted infections as people threw caution to the wind and other garments that they might have had on, and there were thousands of additional births outside of marriage as well, people were urged by the then Archbishop of Canterbury to return to Christian living. And as a consequence, marriage increased. People didn't carry on their way of life that they'd had when the constraints were off. They were obedient. They got married again. And by the early 50s, a national survey found that 2/3 of British people surveyed thought women shouldn't have any sexual experience out of marriage, though only half thought the same for men. So the math never quite works, does it? There's always that bit of inequality. And of course, heterosexuality was the only legal option for men and the only socially acceptable one for women. Two world wars, not to mention all the wars before them, hadn't changed much. The traditional church, traditional family was still the preferred church option, fully endorsed. Change was slow. In 1957, a survey of American attitudes towards singleness found that 80% of people believed that someone who chose to be single was happy, independent, strong? No. Sick, neurotic, and immoral. Nice. And too often, the church hasn't known what to do with single people either. Despite social changes, and of course, a holy book that redefines the purpose of singleness as far back as the first century, the entwining has been strong. But now, more people are living alone than ever before, including nearly 4 million people in England and Wales, part of over 200 million globally. It's really quite a big shift. In America, single people are almost half of the adult population. And the length of marriage has fluctuated too. The average length of a marriage in England and Wales in 2014 was 11.7 years. And I found this little historical fact quite interesting. You can tell I like historical facts by now, I think. But only slightly shorter than this, was marriage in colonial era America, where they were estimated to have lasted 12 years. However, they may have ended more because of diphtheria, malaria, and smallpox than in the present-day home counties, we think. Marriage is happening later too, meaning people spend more of their adult lives single and need new skills to navigate that, but we're being quite slow to catch up. Rather than marrying young in order to set up an adult life and home, it's much more common for people to establish individual independent identities before considering tying themselves to another person. The average age of marriage has been increasing over the last few decades. The marriage historian in America called Stephanie Coontz has calculated that we're now on average single for 50% of what's been known as the prime of life years between 18 and 55. And I know we all have prime of life years outside those years. That's what she said. That's not what I said. Whatever age you are, you're in your prime to me. You all look great. So just putting that out there. And it used to be that it was 20% of the prime of life years back in the 60s. So we're now having to navigate this new stage of adulthood single, where it used to just be you got married young and you stayed married until you died. Marriage is still beloved of government authorities and, of course, the church, but not all Christians, certainly not all the ones I spoke to. And my findings were interesting. I thought they were interesting. Thank you for bearing with me. As throughout history, the experiences of men and women varied, but some things were common. So here's what some people told me, and all but a handful of these people, these 1,500, described themselves as Christian in some shape, and the shapes were many and varied. So, did people expect to be treated differently if they were single? Overall, resoundingly, yes. Over two-thirds thought that couples are more respected than single people in church or Christian culture. Almost as many believe pressure to get married is strong in their faith community. Only just over half said they felt valued and welcomed in Christian life regardless of their relationship status. And just under half felt that Christian life prioritises nuclear families. And yet, outside of the church, marriage is starting to look quite different. In 2017 in Scotland, humanist weddings outnumbered Church of Scotland ceremonies for the first time. We now have heterosexual couples who want civil partnerships rather than marriages trying their case in court. Couples are choosing to personalise their commitments, not with church ceremonies, but with informal ceremonies conducted by friends and family. And then certain groups are overrepresented in the church too. There are more women than men, estimated to be around twice as many women to men, a ratio some of you may be more familiar with than others. This alone has a huge impact on the quality of relationships and the ability to have good friendships, regardless of whether someone wants to get married or not. If you're told by your faith community you should marry inside it, but there are twice as many women as men, but they're not planning on bringing back polygamy, okay, there's a maths problem again. Research by Single Friendly Church shows that more married people choose to go to church than single people, so again, overrepresented, but a third of adults in British churches are single. And unlike society in general, the majority of adults in churches are married. So it's sort of like real life, kind of, but different. And the ethics vary too and cause some debate. Traditionally, and even in the present day, some Christians have been taught to wait until marriage to have sex. Society was fully on board with this too, at least as much as anyone admitted to. It just wasn't the done thing. It wasn't respectable to embrace any other way of life. And for those who still hold to this, is it possible to have a full single life? Two-thirds of my respondents said that church culture expects single people to be abstinent. Around the same number said they felt that society encourages people to lust after each other, and that didn't make things easier either. There may be, in a lot of churches, a don't ask, don't tell approach where personal choices aren't openly discussed, or things may be more hard line and you have to comply or be farewelled, find yourself somewhere else to have a spiritual community. And it can be assumed that anyone who isn't married is somehow effortlessly chaste and patiently waiting for the day they are chosen to be someone's spouse, because often that's the dynamic, that the man is active and the woman is passive. And I'd love to tell you this is all old-fashioned, but it's still what people are hearing, it's still what they're being taught. The assumption may be spot-on for some people, but also wildly off-base for others. They may be expected to be content to be single forever, on hand as a babysitter and church rota filler. I can remember a few years ago, a pastor I had who had eight children saying, just think of all the time you've got to pray. I thought, yeah, sure, I know what you're doing when I'm praying, thanks. Yeah. Yeah. People may be previously married or parenting solo, they're managing to deal with life alone as well. And they're being taught overall views on the importance of marriage. This is how some people told me they'd heard marriage described to them, as a promotion going to the next level, reaching maturity, something that sets people apart and qualifies them for great responsibility now they are a couple, which I thought was it Superman or Spider-Man that's meant to have great responsibility? Anyway, married people too, apparently. The only way to be fulfilled. It's been likened to gaining holiness, learning vital lessons, growing in no ways no other relationship or shape of life could offer. You can see why people feel the pressure. And the way this manifests can depend also on how the sexes are viewed. I ask people, do you think God ordained particular roles for men and women in life and relationships? 40% of people said yes. Aren't they sweet, their little feet? What do they mean by roles? Well, usually a God-chosen order that required male leadership in some form and female submission. Maybe not a harsh dictatorship, but a relationship where decision-making ultimately rested with the husband, who would both protect and provide, although these terms were really rarely explored. And more than one person said to me, well, it means the buck stops with the man. So, and also one American respondent told me it was really also to do with how well you could handle a firearm as to whether you were a true protector. So I did get quite an array of views, yeah. This was regarded as a natural order, and it meant both would flourish if they lived out their place in the hierarchy, ideally minus guns, ideally. And what was particularly hard about this teaching was the suggestion that marriage, especially this kind of marriage, was something that would make the participants closer to God and reflect something about the order of the Trinity. It was all very mystical and mysterious. And when the marriage is perceived as this promised land and this place of divine structure and hierarchy, it's almost going against God in that culture to say you want to do something different, that maybe you want to be more egalitarian or you want to split the decisions differently. But it does go some way to explaining why it's still popular, aside from it being the only legitimate way that people were told they were allowed to have sex in quite a lot of situations. And then I wondered what happens to people who are single in this environment for whatever reason. And many people had been told that God would give them a spouse at the designated time. And until then, they should be on guard, wary of being led astray. I added that. Nobody was actually taught those actions. But if I might start a chastity defense class at the end, if anyone wants to join. See, we'll give it a warm up. Pretend it's yoga or something, I don't know. And until then, until that fateful moment, they should be on guard, wary of being led astray, either into forbidden sexiness or an imbalanced relationship where neither person leads the way, also known as kind of mutual submission or partnership. This was apparently a bad thing. Or even worse, the woman makes the decisions. Whatever next. What's notable is where significant sections of the church had started to move away from this belief, it's begun to reemerge in the mainstream, again, dressed in Christian language. Yeah. You might have noticed the rise of right-wing populist leaders around the world who align with Christians in order to get elected in the first place and in the promotion of the traditional family. And they're stripping back rights that we will probably see as progressive in accordance with this. The inclusion of so-called Christian values is starting to appear in political manifestos and speeches. There are angry online communities of men's rights activists, some who claim to be Christian in an anti-feminist, anti-PC kind of way, who insist society is better when women know their place. Can you guess where it is? At home, in the kitchen, having babies. Yeah. There was quite a funny tweet the other day. I say funny. I mean, okay. Self-declared patriarch, husband, and love coach. Quite the bio if anyone's looking to refresh their social media accounts. Yep. And there's a lot of them, you know, there's a lot building their presence online. He informed the world, and I quote, "Women need the boundaries of the patriarchy and a mission in life, which is usually husband, children, and home. Absent such a structure, they malfunction and destroy civilizations." Yep. Yep, I've got a sign-up sheet for that after the session. You can tick a box whichever civilization you want to destroy. We can do the warm-up as well, also. Yep. But his views aren't particularly different to a lot of Christians. They want a return to traditional roles. Talk of God having given Christianity a masculine feel. Have you heard that one? Muscular Christianity creeping back into conversation. The ongoing teaching that God created a natural order in which both men and women thrive. All these mutterings that women are simply happier as wives and mothers. And I even heard a few saying they didn't really want the vote. They were quite happy in the kitchen back then. They were forced. So, you know, these are Christians that are having these conversations. And there's legislation to ensure that women have few choices, especially in countries that South America, for example, has a few examples of that. And though it may seem shocking to hear what was legalised in previous centuries, it somehow doesn't seem too much like wild conjecture that progress isn't automatic or guaranteed. Those who watch The Handmaid's Tale and news reports from around the world may observe worrying similarities. The echoes through history that men are cleverer, and I'm sure all you men in here are, I'm sure that's not in doubt, and the women offer a guiding morality that can somehow improve and save a man, I mean, this is still being taught. And as unlikely as it may sound, such ideas often came from the heart of the scientific community, home of logic and progress. Here's a little quote. I certainly think that women, though generally superior to men in moral qualities, are inferior intellectually, said Charles Darwin. Yeah. What a guy. So, once again, Christian values in some places are becoming indistinguishable from an ideal that favours male dominance and female submission. So where do single people thrive in such an environment? And why would single people want to be married? And yet, marriage held a strong appeal for a lot of single Christians I spoke to. Over two-thirds I asked said marriage was still a goal for them. But the marriage they were envisioning was a romantic and positive proposition, one of teamwork, partnership, love, and equality. It was also a place where the abstinent got to have sex, so some people were very, very keen for this to take place quickly as well. But one doesn't have to travel too far back to see how different marriage was, particularly for women. And outcomes for girls and women still vary across the world in terms of sex-selective abortion, medical care, contraception, education, and forced marriage for children. But the pervasive view of marriage has always been positive in this country. Can you imagine being that happy? Can you? Marriage gets happier over time, trumpeted the Daily Mail earlier this year. Of course they did. They, along with much of the media, offer regular tips on how to be happily married with certain conditions. Marriage makes you happier, but only if you earn less than $60,000, or own more than one TV, or if you have particular hormone levels, there's another one, or separate homes, or sleep apart, or, and this is the one that comes up the most, if you're a man. Yeah, if you're a man. The positive or negative effects of marriage can't be agreed. Some say it makes you happier, some say it doesn't. It seems that you'll be approximately as happy before as you were after. Marriage itself won't make you happier, it won't fix things. And a lot depends on how happiness is being measured. But there are, as a little aside, some stats on what makes a marriage more likely to last. These are actual findings, but not mine. So, if you want the best chance, anyone who's already married, keep going. This is not to put you off. You're already there. You're doing well. Anyone who isn't, dating for at least 3 years, not marrying for looks or money, having a honeymoon, having a big wedding, classed as over 200 people, apparently you're more than 12 and a half times as likely to divorce if you elope. But the key thing is not spending a lot of money on your big wedding. So your best chance of staying married, according to this research, is to spend less than £1,000, which divided by the 200 guests, after you've removed the cost of outfits, flowers, ceremony, and so on. Yeah. And they can't measure whether a couple is actually happy or not. They're just married. And actually, if your friends have stopped speaking to you because they went home from your wedding starving, you may as well stay married. Why not? What else are you going to do? And also, going to church is a key factor in staying married, which sort of relates to the fact that the church has more married people in it. And when we talk about marriage, we tend to visualise a particular thing, a commitment made for the rest of life. Although I'm not sure she's going to live that long if they don't catch her, so, you know. But an interesting survey by Time magazine in 2014 suggested some other formats that marriage could turn into. There was the presidential marriage. Vows for an initial 4 years, and then after 8 years, you can elect to choose a new partner. And a fifth of respondents quite liked this idea. There was the multiple partner marriage, which 10% of people liked. The till death do us part, very literal, no divorce at all marriage, which nearly a third wanted. And the beta marriage, an option that increased in popularity the younger the respondent. The BISA is a committed partnership that can be dissolved without consequence after 2 years or renewed and formalised if both parties agree. How romantic is that? But that was the one that actually came out the top. So, which one would you go for? If you're with a current partner, you just think it, don't say it out loud, I don't want to cause any issues. Anyone that shouts, till death do us part, BISA, and then looks at each other. I'm not sure what I'm going to do if that happens. But amid all of this, single people come in many shapes now. I mean, literal shapes, but, you know, shapes of life. Rather than the stage before marriage encompasses anything that means not currently married, it's quite an inadequate word. Widowed, divorced, separated, never married, any age, all kinds of experiences. And yet it's very hard not to live under what's been called the shadow of marriage, the default state. The return to family values, which, as we've said, is popular with right-leaning politicians and Christians alike, is equated with marriage. Tax breaks depend on it. We've pushed down that road. Even if we now have the first Prime Minister to live in number 10 with one woman while married to another, and a US President married to his third wife, but both representing very right-leaning politics, and at least one claiming the Bible is his favourite book, though he can't quote any of the verses and he likes the Old and New Testament equally. I think he's never opened it personally, but don't tell him I said that in case I ever want to go to America. Single people were expected to have the gift, a calling from God to stay single, which meant that no one-on-one relationships could happen, no sex at all, and remember, no thoughts of sex either. You had to somehow empty your mind, body, everything of those thoughts, and have a life navigated solo. The fact that this would come with practical challenges, the risks of long-term illness, disability, financial security, home ownership, all of the things that people would have to navigate on their own, were really rarely mentioned. But we know that society is growing more fragmented. Loneliness is increasing. The connectivity of social media can be a lifeline and also an unhelpful reminder of how others are living, or at least how they claim to be. If the church keeps championing marriage as the best state, even if that's simply by modelling it through who appears to have status, value and leadership opportunities, or who, I mean, the same church that I went to with the 8-kid pastor, he used to give couples one weekend a month off for quality time. Quality time. While we put the chairs out. Yeah. Yeah. Championed marriage in that church. Yeah. So, you can see, not that I carry any of this, but hurt and isolation may lurk under the surface, just saying it could happen, that's all. And many good opportunities are being missed to build genuine community. Single people are often forced to look further and work harder to find it. In my research, those who were looking not to be single faced a wider culture for dating that their married church mates often knew nothing about. They described it as challenging, confusing, contradictory, hard and uncertain. What fun. People believed there was pressure on new relationships in church as marriage was expected to happen quickly. And they thought church leaders are often out of touch with what's happening romantically in their congregations, but my suspicion is quite a lot of church leaders would be relieved about that and just want to keep it that way. Just 2% of people who responded to me said they felt called to be single, but 40% were. They often felt pressured to put on a brave face. But the reality was quite different. Somehow, for the church to stop idolising marriage above other ways of life, foundational things need to change. Instead of talking about being countercultural, it really needs to happen. Everyone needs to know that they are valued, no matter what. We're part of a society that encourages people to hoard, not only not to share, but not to want to share. Me and mine, to aspire and attain, not to humble ourselves and admit vulnerability. It's why, in part, the Christian message has been so revolutionary. The New Testament believers sold their possessions and pooled their money so that no one went without. They modelled community. They were told that they should only marry if they were about to explode with desire, but otherwise were advised to stay single. And there's an American theologian, Jennifer Wright Nust, who, and I paraphrase here, said, if we really took that seriously, there would probably be a lot more examples of people literally becoming eunuchs as there were in the early days of the church. But I'm not here, just so anyone knows, I'm not here to encourage a return to that at all. I'm just saying that's what she said. So please, nobody do that. Okay. So again, when I ask people if they'd consider living in mixed community, not with me, just more generally, it would have to be a big house, wouldn't it? Just over a third said yes, so it would have to be a very big house. And over two-thirds of single people said marriage was still a goal for them, often after giving many reasons why they weren't treated as well as married people, so no surprise there. At some level, many people value the idea of investing in others in the long term. Research suggests that people of all faiths volunteer more than those who have none. And indeed, in my research, over 70% were up for mentoring or supporting others. This is an interesting aside. Someone highly religious is no more likely to recycle than anyone else. I'm just going to put that out there. That was just an extra fact. So what are the alternatives for housing? Could we de-pedestal marriage by looking at alternatives to the one house, one family unit? It's tricky. Even as council houses are allocated, they go up on a size of family basis. So you may find larger houses actually left empty because there isn't a family size to fit, whereas you could have a combination who could actually make a home there. Have you heard of the Hofjes? They're not people. They're actually purpose-built communities centred around courtyards where single people could live together but with independence. They're in the Netherlands. A well-known one of these was built in the 15th century for religious women who didn't want to go into convents, and it's still lived in by single women today. Or have you heard of Bestie Row? It's some land bought by a group of older people who built their own small matching properties to see out life together. While researching the book, I spoke to people who joined temporary monastic communities and those who committed to lifelong arrangements. Others who created scattered community, committing to prioritise each other, though not living together. But most of society seems unwilling anytime soon to accommodate or aspire to living arrangements that are anything other than standard. So people are taking action, choosing communal living for the long term, like housing cooperatives, often driven by property prices too. But one woman I spoke to had moved into a commune in California with single people and couples with children and said that even if she married in the future, she would now seek out a similar arrangement rather than live just as a couple. What she'd expected to be difficult, she's now described as an enriching gift. But is the church overall doing anything active to help with this? While loneliness grows, are all models being reinforced over and over? You'll be fine as long as you find someone. What does a flourishing community in which everyone thrives actually look like? And if the church has more women than men, are expectations being projected onto them? Are they expected to be more available to help? Putting the chairs out, like I said. Yeah. And to be the backbone of the church while being seen as having no emotional needs. But it doesn't mean that they don't have responsibilities. They're going to be supporting themselves and maybe children or other relatives too. So who is meeting their needs practically and pastorally? Who's sharing the burdens of life with them? And there are practical things too that could be done simply. Eating together is significant. Eating alone by choice is great, but to have no options is something else altogether. What regular opportunities could be created for people to share the real daily moments of life together? The ones where it doesn't matter if you have a spouse or not. And how much is friendship valued? There's a joke that I stumbled across that the most unbelievable thing about Jesus is him being a man in his 30s and having 12 close friends. Yeah. Often it's a secondary consideration, something to be replaced by marriage. But marriage will not be the answer to all relational needs. You can be married and still lonely. The Bible emphasises different priorities, but the church often does not. Focus may be on church attendance and groups, but lasting friendship won't be built in passing. Loneliness itself has been shown to have severe effects on physical and mental health, and I suspect spiritual health too. But it can be easy to be insular and to isolate yourself if you're told you're lacking something socially important, the relationship that society judges to be the most vital and desirable one. And the church shouldn't be adding to that. Church could be and should be a place where all are welcome and none are forgotten, where legal status doesn't put one person above another, but it will take effort and a desire to change. We need to think about how special days are marked. Our birthdays assumed to be something married people celebrate together with a hashtag date night or hashtag hot wife or some of the terrible things you might have seen on social media. Are weddings the biggest events or most regarded as achievements? Who actually makes up the fabric and community of the church? And who are they? Who is the teaching for? Who's actually speaking to them? As one interviewee for my book asked, who does what a mother, sister, or brother would do? Who is marking the significant occasions? Who is celebrating success, whatever success looks like for each person? And most importantly, how do people know that they are loved? It's been single people over the years, often single women, who have pioneered new ways of doing things, right back to the surplus women and way beyond. It's likely not much will change in the church's love affair with the nuclear family on its own. So take courage, look around, and see what you could do. The end.
Thank you very much. We do have a short time for questions. If anyone has a question, just put your hand in the air and I'll run to you and then go for
it. I will
there.
Do my best to answer it.
And if we don't have time for that, also, you
oh,
will
yeah,
be,
yeah. Come and make me look not totally unpopular at the book signing.
I don't think that's going to happen. I think these guys would have that. Also, I'll quickly say the end bit so that we can end on the questions.
Okay.
Wit and wisdom are the motto of Greenbelt this year. I think we can all agree that that was wisdom and hilarious. So thank you very much. Have another big round of applause. So has anyone got any questions? Yeah.
Thank you. That was really, really interesting.
Oh,
and fantastic research for people to go back to the communities that they're in. I just wondered about the description of the love affair with nuclear family, because even for those who are in marriages in Christian communities, if that doesn't actually lead to children, through infertility, that is a whole other kind of kettle of fish, as it were. And it's that's another strand. And so I just wondered if that had come up in your research, because that is a whole new universe of difficulty. So even for those who are married, or for those who adopt, or for those who have non-traditional families, like single parents and so on. So I just wondered if that has come up in your research as well.
It definitely has. And there are people that I would recommend checking out. Salt, Water and Honey are an organisation who that, and Sheridan Voysey is a writer who's covered a lot of those things more than I have. But it definitely did come up. And one of the key statistics out of the whole bit of work that I did was when I asked people if their relationship history, how they describe it, only 13% said happy and straightforward. So even those who would describe themselves as happy now were still saying, well, it still was bumpy. There was still all this stuff that didn't get talked about. And I think you're absolutely right. Those are it's a myth that this thing exists. And often we hear it, people who have platforms, because they personify that. It's this kind of photogenic lifestyle where it looks like they've got it all together. And those things have happened without incident, or they've happened, as far as anyone knows, easily, and everything looks perfect. And I think that mythology is really dangerous, because it encourages us to believe it's attainable. And I started to call it normalizing the exceptions, this idea that actually most people don't have that at all. And yet, that's kind of what we're being presented all the time. We just need to reach further and try harder, and then you'll get this, you know, unicorn of a relationship that will fulfill you. And I talked to lots of married people who said, I haven't been, you know, as lonely as since I got married, you know, or there's lots of other things. And I think that vulnerability is so necessary to start bringing all this stuff into the open and taking marriage off the pedestal as the answer. Otherwise, I think we're just going to end up with this same division. You know, someone asked me earlier today about are things going in the right direction. I said, well, they're always going in different directions. Everyone's life experience is unique to them as well. It's always going to be different. I think intergenerational friendships are a really good way that the church can actually bring people together to start having some honest and open conversations about these things. Because, you know, all those examples that you gave, they're so much a part of this, you know. And I think if you talk to people who seem to have it all together, they will probably tell you all the reasons that they don't as well. So, you know, if anyone takes anything from this, it's the idea that we can demythologize a lot of this stuff that's being presented to us as the answer, when really, you know, it's not the only thing. So there will be some people who do you know, a tiny percentage will say, I did all these things and it worked for me. And I had some people who actually wrote to me in order to say that, you know, I did everything right and it all turned out right, just so you know. Great, good for you. But the majority did not have that experience. So I would just really like to encourage people to share that and to find, you know, there are people who are starting to put resources out there and to want to bring people together, just to take away from this idea that, you know, there's something wrong if it hasn't gone that way, because I think that's very lonely for people as well.
We've got time for a couple more.
You quite rightly talk about leadership as leadership of the church being the people that can drive this change. The difficulty I have is I'm a vicar in the Church of England, and yeah. If I turn up at a job interview, in no other profession I've ever been involved in will the other candidates bring their wife and children to the interview. And when the church is presented with this perfect, seemingly perfect model, they will normally choose that. And so therefore are we... If it doesn't become a self-perpetuating thing, that the leadership itself is never going to, it doesn't change because they always want that perfect family that's presented against a single woman or a divorced person or whatever else might come through the door.
I think it is for church leaders in particular. Like I said, in semi-jokingly, I think there are some that are probably quite glad that their church community feel that they don't know what the issues are. But I think there is that pressure that you can carry alone if you're not careful. And a vicar friend of mine and her husband, who works in the civil service, said, well, I'll appear in her church website picture if she comes and leans on my shoulder in my next civil service bio. You know, it's this idea that somehow those things are equal. So I think it is pushing that stuff back up the chain. It is saying, I'm not going to do that. Because I talked to male clergy who said, I'm considered odd if I'm not married. Or, you know, it's seen as getting, you know, buy one, get one free if you have a wife that's going to come and do all the pastoral bits. So I think it's so ingrained, you know, that we need to start just picking away at it anywhere we can and starting to have those conversations. And there are amazing church leaders pioneering completely different ways of doing things. And I heartily, you know, endorse and encourage all of those things, because I think it has to come from all levels. It shouldn't just be church leaders, and it shouldn't just be the people kind of on the margin saying, please, can we change? I think that conversation needs to bring everyone together and actually start to generate some real heartfelt openness. Does that answer your question-ish? I'll write to the Archbishop. Maybe that would do it. Yeah.
Whatever.
You spoke about single people and about married people. What about people that are not single but are not married? People who are in long or maybe even short-term relationships but have not made the commitment of marriage.
What particularly interests you about those people?
How they're received in the church, how common it is in the church.
Well, I did have people contact me who were in relationships as well. And they sort of talked about the fact that it was expected that they would get married quite quickly. So I know every church is different, but there were certainly quite a lot of responses. And I've been to places like this as well, where if you happen to make eye contact over coffee, people are like, oh, I'm getting a hat. You know, it won't take long. So I think often the church is focused on people either abstaining from any physical contact and that being the mark of a healthy relationship. And so I think it's good. And again, I write more about this than I spoke about today. But the idea that we focus on the mark of a good relationship being rushing to marriage and then all, you know, all bets are off, do whatever you want. Whereas actually we don't really work on developing emotional health, or even getting to know each other properly. You know, one of the stats about early marriage, not marriage in the 1950s, people married really quickly, which I know quite a lot of Christian couples are encouraged to do. So they could often go from meeting to marriage within 6 months, which meant they couldn't really know each other that well. They were going on what they thought they knew at that point. And often they were going into roles that were preordained for them. So I think there's a great opportunity for people now not to fall into that trap. And I think a lot of people don't. It may work out brilliantly. You know, I heard from people who got together and, you know, engaged within 2 weeks and still really happy. But again, I think to sort of try and normalize that as the way it should be, I think if everyone's encouraged to take their own journey and to trust their discernment and to develop discernment rather than being given a rule book, I think we'll probably all be better off, because it will be different for every couple.
Thank you very much. Just quickly.
We've got 10 minutes, yeah?
We've got 10 minutes. We've got more questions.
Ten minutes? I need to think of some answers.
Hello.
Hello. Hi. Sorry, the lights are a bit bright, so I'm staring. Hello.
No, we're just looking at an angel.
I like your hair.
Thank you.
Nice colour. Lovely colour.
So I wanted to... There was two things that I want to say. One is that someone, for the sake of convenience, I will describe as my great aunt, was one of the surplus women. Ah. And it was the most enormous gift for her. And it meant that she could quietly live her life with her female partner. With no eyebrows being raised. And if she hadn't been surplus, she would have been absolutely miserable.
Yeah, yeah.
The other thing that I was going to ask you is if you can speak a bit about the age breakdown of the demographics between men and women in the church, because I work for quite a traditional High Anglican Church, and we have an overrepresentation of women because most of them are widows, and it's quite well known that women have a higher life expectancy than men. So you end up with loads of old ladies.
I probably don't have the information on that. I would encourage Single Friendly Church as a place to go and seek out some stuff about that, and I use some of their research in my book, but I think people who contacted me crossed the age range. But I didn't really hear from many older widows. But I know the Church Times did quite a feature a while ago about the fact that these women are often the backbone of the church. They are the people that keep things going. You know, they are the volunteers. Yeah, and actually, if people are, you know, moving away from church as a whole or de-churching, there's a trend that's been identified in America called women who love Jesus but not the church. And I think as women are sort of moving away from feeling that commitment, you know, when there was criticism a few years ago about the feminization of the church, that actually those women who'd served faithfully were suddenly being mocked or derided for it, or being told they were putting men off, and that actually we should focus on getting men back in, and all these very macho campaigns with lots of fire and MMA and mixed martial arts. I won't demonstrate it for you, but a lot of really like ultra macho, let's get the men back in and then they'll have all these women to choose from or women to do things for them. It was really unhealthy. So my research didn't cover that sort of breakdown, but I certainly have noticed that the younger women are kind of put in a position where they're expected to almost like hold on, and then suddenly they're not younger women anymore. And I had younger women write to me saying, well, I was told that all I had to do was kind of wait and be faithful and God would, you know, provide someone. But I see all these women in their 40s and 50s and so on who did that, and it hasn't happened. So there's all this kind of build of expectation that just isn't good for anyone. You know, it's... people could live very happy lives, and it's a lovely story about your great aunt. I think that's amazing because those women were such pioneers. There's stories of like Lonely Hearts ads where some of the women would say, this is the level of physical disability I'll accept in a soldier coming back from war just so I'm not left, you know, left on my own. You know, this sort of, yeah, there's you know, really kind of powerful stories out there. So it's lovely to actually hear a positive story of someone that just made the most of that situation and wasn't pushed into a situation where they were required to have a marriage they didn't want. So, yeah, it's really nice.
Hello.
Hi.
I was wondering about, how... Closer? Thank you. Sorry. I was wondering about how divorce, was what your research found about how much that increased or decreased over the years, and maybe between different age demographics or within the church or outside the church.
It's constantly debated. You will find research that says Christians are more likely to get divorced or less likely to get divorced. It's always debated. Any organisation that exists to promote marriage will constantly say that marriage is great, everyone should get married, and anything else equals instability. But actually, I guess the most positive thing that I came across in terms of divorce was that people weren't condemning about it, that there was only a tiny percentage of people, and they still did exist, who said there's never a reason for people to get divorced if they're Christian, they should always stay married. But actually, for the most people, they were much more kind of understanding of the nuances of relationships, and particularly, I think, where abuse may have been overlooked. There were certainly some sort of church cultures that would encourage women to just stay no matter what. And so I think there's definitely a healthier approach now to the idea that it needs to be mutual. There needs to be mutual respect and love and a growing awareness of, you know, patterns of domestic abuse or coercive control or other things that, again, fall into this idea of almost like male headship and female submission being really turned into something nasty and unpleasant. So not a mutually beneficial thing, but actually something that women who would be much better off being divorced were forced to kind of stay in the thick of. But I mostly have people sort of talking theoretically about divorce, and some people, nobody really said they'd been treated badly after it. They hadn't been rejected by their churches or anything that really felt, you know, like a really bad story. Mostly people were quite nuanced and understanding about it. And I think those phrases that people used to have, like the kind of God hates divorce, have been changed. The meaning of that has been changed from this idea that, like, therefore you should never do it because you'll make God cry, which was kind of how it used to be put across, to this idea of, well, it's causing people pain, you know, it's a breakdown of a relationship, and therefore it's a really sad and difficult thing. But actually some people will definitely be better off outside of those situations. So it wasn't the main area that I covered, but that was kind of what came back from it.
Hello.
Yeah. Hi. Hello.
Firstly, thank you. Secondly, so I've read that of the single men in church, they are happy to find a woman inside the church or outside the church, whereas single women in church are only looking for men inside the church. I wondered whether you'd found that in your research, and if so, if
I'm going to lean on my, I'm going to lean on the podium like it's a bar and go, well, what do you think I found out? So the talk wasn't really about this, but this is all the kind of stuff that I looked at elsewhere. I asked people what their non-negotiables were in a partner. Women's number one non-negotiable was same faith. Men's number one non-negotiable was not same faith. They wanted someone who was kind. So not only did we have this number mismatch, not only did we have twice as many women as men, we had fewer men whose non-negotiable was a woman of the same faith. So there were some that absolutely did want someone who shared their faith, but there were plenty more who were quite happy to look outside of that. And even some who said things like, well, I would date women who aren't Christians, but in the end, unless they converted, I probably wouldn't marry them. So I don't know how open people were about these conversations at the time, but yeah, it was definitely a mismatch. There is a statistic that I worked out that I won't try and remember, well, I'll remember it badly now, but it was something like a sort of 12 and a half men to every 45 women or something like that, if you took same faith as the non-negotiable. So women much more wanted an equal partner than men did as well. So maybe it's just, you know, the people who responded to me, but they weren't the most traditional, I wouldn't say, the people who responded, but it was definitely there. It was definitely something that women were often the ones being told, this is what I want, this is what I'll wait for, this is what I'll pursue. And men were like, well, see what happens, you know, maybe it will, maybe it won't be someone who's also a Christian. So yeah, I don't really know where you start tackling that one, because I think you've already got a number imbalance, and women actually were often the ones told not to go looking outside the church, but when they did, they would often bring partners back in and integrate them into their faith lives in a way that was quite positive. So I spoke to, I've got a whole chapter of stories of women who did that, who pursued those sorts of relationships. And I did a separate survey for that because I was really interested in this undiscussed area. So what do you do if you've got this huge maths problem that isn't going to work itself out unless you start allocating, you know, two women to every man? It's just not going to, it's not going to work. And I'm not advocating for that, just so you know. But what was interesting is then talking to these women and saying, okay, what did you expect to happen? What was your kind of worst case scenario? And none of them had had the worst case scenario. They were all people who kind of volunteered to talk to me and say, yep, you know, I was really uncertain at first, and actually my family didn't treat him very well, and it just kind of confirmed what he already feared about Christians. So actually this idea of being more open and more welcoming goes a long way to offsetting some of this gender imbalance, or starting to readdress it. Because actually if you're then saying women sit tight, men will have like curry and bonfire nights and bring more men in, and then we'll marry you all off, whereas actually, you know, these men who weren't Christians were really happy to be in relationships with women who were, and then also integrate. They weren't kind of trying to pull the women out of those situations, whereas often, you know, the women were being told, don't do it, and the men weren't really being told anything. They were just, I sort of came up with the term crown prince syndrome for some of them, because they were actually deliberately kind of saying, well, and one guy was like, well, I don't want to make eye contact with anyone in case I end up breaking their heart. I was like, ooh, your eyes aren't that great. But, you know, it was this real kind of fear that they had of just, well, you know, it all rests on me as the pursuer that, and yeah, these were quite liberal men as well. They just bought into this social thing of, you know, women, this is what women want. They desperately want to marry me. And, you know, the women were like, not that fussed actually, thanks. And they would happily go elsewhere and start meeting people through having jobs and having hobbies and having lives and all these crazy independent things that women have now. And the church hasn't really caught up with that. So, yeah, men were definitely open to more on paper, but actually women in practice were thinking it through. And I asked about motivations, what made them go and do that. And there's obviously, you know, I think it'd be good if you all read the book, but there's lots of good stuff in there if it's a situation you're contemplating or finding yourself in or know people who are, because I think at the moment it's not something the church has faced into at all, this idea that it's actually maybe okay to go and do that, because otherwise you're going to be a very frustrated woman. I don't want very frustrated women. Just don't.
Hi there, I'm up the back.
Hello.
So you'd kind of pulled apart some of the things we've come to understand about marriage that the Bible teaches and said that's not really what the Bible does teach about marriage. I'm just curious if you think the Christian tradition or as followers of Jesus, is there kind of correct teaching on marriage and relationships?
Well,
or is it a kind of anything goes approach?
I think there's got to be a lot that if it's... It's got to work for everyone. I think I did have people contact me who said, you know, who totally bought in to, I should submit, my husband should lead me, we're really happy, he has the harder job, he has to love me as Christ loves the church, was what she'd written to me. And I had another couple, a man who wrote in, not the woman who wrote in, but the man who wrote in and said, me and my wife became Christians in quite an egalitarian church, and then we've moved to a more soft, complementarian one, and we both think it's much better now that I'm the leader. And I thought, well, I want your wife to verify that actually as well, because I only had his word for it. So I think it may be that people find something that represents their interpretation of Christianity in a way that is honouring the other person and the wider community and helping both to flourish. And, you know, we're not going to transform everyone, every part of society, just like that. But I think I wouldn't say to that couple who feel absolutely fulfilled with that slightly hierarchical arrangement that they should stop and do everything differently. You know, I think it's working out what you interpret are the important bits. I felt that there was quite a lot that we didn't focus on in terms of relationships, like the fruits of the Spirit. You know, we weren't talking about how we, you know, show kindness or bring peace and joy. And I think those were things that we neglected when we talked about relationships. We tended to talk about them quite a lot in the abstract. And I thought they were actually really important in terms of how we related to each other. You know, people would write in about their dating experiences, and you could say there are no fruits of the Spirit present in this interaction. You know, you could just see frustration and hurt and all the ways that people describe the dating culture. So to me, those things, the kind of fruit of the Spirit and how we treat people, was much more important than this idea of who was in charge. So I don't have a fully formed theology of it, but that was my sense as I went through a lot of it, that actually if people employed some of those more general terms of how we should relate to each other, then relationships would become healthier.
I think we've got one more question from someone over there.
Yeah, one bit you seemed, that doesn't seem to have come up.
Please, can you wave your hand so I can see where you are? Hello. Hi.
Hello. One bit that doesn't seem to have come up is the view that single people are damaged goods and not really Christian and shouldn't be there.
Ooh. Is that something that you've heard in your...
Yes, I was fairly Asperger-ish in a parish of mostly very standardised people.
Right.
And I'm sure I can't be the only one who's been through that sort of thing.
I'm trying to think if there were any specific examples of that as I was doing the research. I mean, what people mostly talked about was this idea that just they'd been taught and they'd absorbed that marriage was better. So what seemed to be the flip side of that was that single people weren't really talked about. There wasn't a lot of teaching for single people. I asked a professor at a theological college about the kind of teaching he did about relationships, and he said he would sometimes go to rooms of maybe 400 church leaders, and he would say, put your hands up if your church does a kind of marriage enrichment course or something similar. And he would say about, I think it was like 70% of people put their hands up, and he'd say, what do you do to enrich single people? And he would say, a handful of people would say, we do something. And so there was this automatic imbalance that it was marriage that was seen to be the only thing that actually was worthy of attention. So I don't think people were necessarily saying that they were told those things about themselves. And I'm really sorry if that did happen to you. It was more that they were just not really taken into account at all. It was much more, well, you know, you're single, you're either waiting to get married, or look at you serving faithfully, doing the church flowers, or isn't it great that you're always there to babysit? It was just single people's emotional needs just weren't looked after, really. So they weren't really pastored a lot of the time, and they weren't really discipled in any way. They were just kind of left to be single because they weren't in a situation that needed mediation the way that marriage might. So marriage was, how do we keep you together? How do we make sure that this continues to flourish? Whereas for single people, in fact, some people told me that the singleness talk in their church every year was done by the married vicar. So, you know, it was an aside. And I think it's good to see, like I said, single-friendly church and other people now, particularly, so there's a few American writers who've started to talk about, you know, singleness and, you know, the gift that it can be, because it just isn't there. You know, it wasn't that people were told there was anything wrong with them as such. It was more that they just weren't addressed in their own situations. It was just that they were expected to get on with it, and marriage was the thing that the church focused on.
Thank you very much.
That's all right.
Thank you for listening to Great Thinking, Ideas and Conversations from Greenbelt. At Greenbelt, we make a space where artistry meets activism, where the political meets the practical, where the sacred meets the secular. We think we're somewhere to dream up a better world, to dance and debate, to pray and to party. Visit greenbelt.org.uk to browse and download other great thinking from our recorded catalogue. We're Greenbelt. We're somewhere to believe in.